Hello and welcome to On Belonging, the podcast where we look at all aspects of belonging and talk to wonderful guests with different perspectives. Delighted today to welcome my guest, Professor Emma Parry of Cranfield University Business School. Emma, you're Professor of HR.
I am, yes. My background's actually in occupational psychology, which you might not have known. But for the past 18 years, I've worked in human resource management. So I describe myself as a lapsed psychologist, if you like. And I'm now a professor in human resource management, and I lead a group at Cranfield called the Changing World of Work Group that basically does what it says on the tin, I guess. So we work on helping organisations to meet the challenges of the changing world of work, whether that's about emerging technologies or changing demographics, or more recently, of course, dealing with some of the challenges presented by COVID-19 and the current situation that we're in.
Indeed, changing world of work at a time where that's accelerated hugely. And in terms of the world of work, both your apparently lapsed psychology, I bet you've jumped straight back into all sorts of aspects. Belonging has been quite an important theme during that time. I used to describe belonging, and because it's so deep rooted for people and it's hard for people to sort of get what it really means and how it's relevant. I used to say, well, imagine we're all isolated from each other, you know, oh God. So tell me a little bit about changing world of work and belonging and the particular relevance of belonging to the effectiveness of all of that?
It's an interesting question, actually, because belonging, I think, has become a bit of a buzzword in the last couple of years. I think lots of people are talking about belonging, but actually I think it's something that's really important and something that it's important for us to reflect on. So quite often I think we see people talk about belonging in relation to inclusion, you know, when they're talking about perhaps diversity and inclusion. But actually, for me, I think it can mean lots of things. And I think it's really important that we broaden our understanding of belonging and think about what it means more broadly. So if I talk about what I think it means, perhaps.
Yes, do. What does it mean to you?
So for me, it's about being in a place, I guess, where you feel comfortable, you feel included, you feel like you're in the right place. So it's partly about identity, I guess, or social identity. You know, does this place or this group, this community that I'm part of fit with the person that I am or want to be? It's partly about how this place, and when I say place, I mean place in the, you know, kind of psychological sense, not necessarily physical. But does this place, you know, it's partly about how this place makes me feel. Do I feel valued? Do I feel part of the community here? You know, and for me, that's much more broad than issues around diversity and inclusion. Although, of course, that's an important part of it because it should feel like that for everyone. But it's also, I think, about how you understand your role in a particular community, how you can contribute to that community, what your value is in that community, and so on and so forth.
Yes, well, thank you. I agree with that. I also see it as a really broad view. And while the work on diversity and inclusion is very important and has become particularly in sharp light, right, with the real brutalities of exclusion and racism being thrown very clear to everybody recently, it is much broader. So I often see belonging being important around ethics or safety or, you know, other things. But simply for each of us to feel that we're in, if you like, culture is the environment in which we grow. So are we in the culture? Do we belong in the place in which we can thrive as individuals and the whole organization can thrive as a result of that? So I think for the HR world, there's quite an interesting overlap. It's almost like you're the pivot in that very delicate balance between the individual and the organization. Does that sort of fit with your interpretation of it all?
I think so. I mean, for me, I think HR and HR's role in an organisation. So if we're talking about belonging within organisations for a moment, I think HR is key in that. And I also think belonging is key in what the role of HR should be. So actually the two fit very closely together. I mean, if you think about what you said about growing, you know, my definitions around feeling valued, I mean, HR's role is really about how we create that environment that's about supporting people, that's about making them feel valued, that understanding what their contribution is, and that allows them to grow and develop within an organization. And if that's not HR's job, you know, alongside managers as well, of course, then I don't know whose job it is, really. So
I like that very much. I like the notion of being valued. There's a great deal of emphasis on values. And as you know, because we did do a little bit of work on this last year together, I'm always very bothered about saying what we value so that we're not just talking about some kind of vague laundry list. Our values are blah, blah, and blah. But if you take that right through to being valued, that is both personal and, well, it could be an organization, as you said, but it could be a societal thing. You know, are we valuing the people in our society who are holding us all together? Or are we not really giving fair value back? You know, so being valued is I like that. We'll hold that theme. And in terms of the relationship between being valued and what we value, when we were looking at the project with some colleagues at Cranfield University, mm-hmm. someone said, well, we need to find some of the academic work. And looking through it, I said, oh, right, well, it looks like the academic work is from Professor Emma Parry of Cranfield University. So you've done some work around the notion of values and how they're expressed. So if we sort of travel from that into the notion of how then you value people back, how well do people do that? How much is there nice rhetoric of saying stuff? How much is there good doing of it?
I think it's very mixed. I think it's become very fashionable for organisations to espouse their values in the last 10 years. And some of that is about saying, hey, look, we have some values. No, I think we've seen a stream in the last 10, 20 years of organisations behaving very badly in some cases. And the backlash of that has been people saying to customers and potentially customers, you know, we're a values-based organisation. The other part of that, and perhaps the more important part in relation to what we're talking about, is really also advertising out to potential employees or potential members of the organisation what you're about.
Mm.
You know, so we've seen a lot of organisations say, look, you know, we have these values, we're ambitious, I'm going to state all the Cranfield ones now, aren't I?
Yeah.
We value community, we value ambition and impact and respect, in case you didn't think I could remember what they were. But it's been about attracting people and retaining people, you know, that also value the same things. So I think some organisations have been very good at doing that. I can remember doing some work with the BBC 10 years ago. I think they were quite early in this process. And at the time, I can remember being very impressed, actually, with the job that they were doing in kind of going through and working out what people valued in their organisation in a similar way to what we did. But then actually realigning all of their people processes so that they reflected those values.
Yes. So that's coming back to your definition about being valued, that those are the terms under which you are valued and that is rooted, that's deeply inside everything in the way the organisation works and one's daily experience. So I was going to say anybody you admire, and that's a nice, because that was pretty comprehensive work, the BBC's work. And I think there was a lot of soul searching around it as well. So it can be done. And then it's sort of held up as a reference, you know, when difficult decisions are made. But back to the sort of the individual view, it's that choice of at the beginning of new work or moving to somewhere, or, you know, do I join this club or do I shop at this place? Does that place respect and reflect what I value? So do I want to interchange with that? But also then, have I experienced what was promised, what was said, or do I feel sort of excluded rather than included, sort of working off some of the basis of your definitions earlier in our conversation? Those things, I think, become quite intuitive and quick. And once the harm is done, the language changes a little bit. I mean, sometimes I've been to places where you know from the news that there's been some really bad experience, and you can feel gradually, and I won't name, but, you know, maybe it's a retailer or hospitality where you've got a very close contact as a customer to those people who are frontline in the organisation. And you sense that, you know, the spirits are down. There's a kind of, you know, the shoulders are weighty. There just is not a pride in being part of that. And sometimes the language reflects it, doesn't it? You hear people say, well, they, i.e., you know, management or the organisation, not me, I'm not part of that. They have said it's like that. Oh, no, if it was me making this choice, I'd have done things differently. I'm afraid it's not, you know, which is sort of the computer says no, but it's computer says no with a little bit of personal care. Like, this thing that's happening doesn't reflect the values that I would give to you. So the disconnect can be harsh to deal with, but very hard to recover from, I think.
Absolutely. And I mean, in the HR world, we talk a lot about the psychological contract, which is a similar idea. You know, this kind of implicit contract that you have with your employer, the things that attracts you to work for them, of which values is a big part, and the things that they expect from you. And when we see that violated, you know, than you do. I mean, you see stress in individual employees, you see a lack of engagement, a disengagement, even, you know, a lack of commitment, and people leave. You know, you see rises in absenteeism. So it's very, very difficult. And interestingly, I think, especially with the times that we're in, what we've seen historically is that actually when there are times in an organization's history when actually it's compelled to break the psychological contract or to go against some of the things that it's espoused because of the situation. So when you move into severe recessions would be a classic example of that. Actually, the organisations that do that well, even though you might say that their values have shifted or they've been forced to shift their values, actually, they, you know, they're the ones that communicate and engage the employees in those conversations and make joint decisions. So there are ways to overcome that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like there's a higher level value set around communication and collaboration, community, I guess, in Cranfield sense, that would, you know, that takes them forward.
I think that's exactly it. And the delicacy of all of that, which, as you said earlier, is not just if it's anybody's responsibility, I guess it sits with HR. But in a sense, it's everybody's responsibility, isn't it? I mean, it's leaders' responsibility. But the delicacy of all of that does become much more stressed. And so, you know, the psychological contract, as you say, and not just in employment, I think it's the same in broader societal terms where there are plenty of examples around, you know, sort of the A-level results. I know Cranfield is purely a postgrad university. You're not dealing with any of that undergraduate application. I bet there's a sigh of relief being breathed. And it becomes so impossible. I mean, you know that you're weighing up a young person's entire future. What horrible decisions to have to make. There is a sense in the anger and anguish of what appears to be a sort of very distant and almost randomized way of selection, that psychological contract, which was based on work hard, do your best, here's your performance, and your world will move along if you achieve that standard. It feels like that's been broken. So, that, for example,
no,
is the
I agree.
Kind of thing.
And I think especially in the conditions of work, I mean, we've heard stories over the last couple of days of students that were perhaps at schools with less of a good reputation, that were perhaps in some of the poorer segments of society, you know, where they'd obviously been given this value base of, you know, work hard, you're intelligent, you can rise above this. And then to be told, well, actually, you did that, but we're going to judge you on your school, which is 24 hours ago is where we were.
Yeah, and the sense of injustice. I mean, this is where I think there might be something interesting from a societal point of view about where that sense of injustice and inequity, and I know there are huge things happening. 2020 has proved to be the most extraordinary year. Talk about changing world of work, just changing world, just everything. We're just sort of rolling from one to the next of those dislocations and disruptions. Quite where that goes is going to be a very interesting thing to observe. But one thing I do wonder about is whether a younger generation almost begins to reframe its own sense of belonging and its own code. And what I'm mostly seeing is a much greater sense of consideration and awareness and thinking. Maybe the kids are all right, let's hope.
Yeah, let's hope so. I mean, it's really interesting, I think, because as you probably know, I've done quite a lot of work around generational diversity and attitude shift. And one of the things we see is that when you do have a break or a shock to the system, if you like, that's when you really see a break or a split between generations. So the last time we really had a split was when the Second World War happened. You know,
yes.
It's been continuous attitude change. But now, of course, we have another one. So it'll be really interesting to see, I think, if we get a generation of teenagers that have grown up now with completely different attitudes and values and what they look like.
Yes. And in this series on belonging, there's a couple of people. I won't name them because I haven't got the dates pinned, so I, you know, you always hold your fingers crossed. But there's a couple of people who are well placed to comment. I'm interested to see from a sort of policy making and almost a governmental point of view, but not party politics. So I'm find a senior figure from a sort of neutral place and a policy making place about how do you even make those decisions? How does one make those considerations? So I find that a very important area to look at. I'm pleased that you've raised the intergenerational exchange. Sometimes in organisations, that's been a thing that's been overlooked in terms of diversity and inclusion, but in terms of belonging. And I did hear of one very interesting story. it was part of the Virgin Group. It was either Virgin Atlantic or Virgin Trains, and I actually can't remember, but where they positively had an intergenerational mentoring matching scheme, but it was like reverse mentoring as well. So the younger people were, the older people were helping some of the younger people through life challenges or getting career moving and all the obvious sort of from that way round, because we live in this sort of gerontocracy perspective, don't we? But the other way round was the complete revelation, just how helpful that was, how useful that was. Is there anything else in terms of nurturing a sense of belonging? Are there any other angles you want to take us at before we move to something, a slightly different theme?
I'm a big believer in psychological safety. So for me, I think of an important thing in this is allowing people that safe space. I mean, again, you mentioned growth and allowing people to grow. People need a safe space to do that within the organization. So they need support around them, but they also need to know that they can, you know, that they can experiment. They need to know kind of that what they're supposed to be doing and their contribution, but also that they're in the right place and they've got the psychological safety to actually grow and take the chances that they need to do that within reason, of course. So for me, I think psychological safety, see, I'm always a psychologist, really.
You can't take it out, okay? You're saying lapse, but, you know, we can hear.
Yeah, but for me, psychological safety is an important thing in organisations. And one of the reasons I've, you know, not to make it about me, but one of the reasons I've always enjoyed working at Cranfield is because I feel as though I've always had that autonomy and freedom and that space within a certain system of expectations that I need to meet to actually carve out my own career and contribute in the way that I see best and to do that and to grow in the way that I want to grow. And I think that's important for people, and especially younger people, actually, with the evidence that people are becoming more individualistic rather than less individualistic over time.
Although that's a generational thing that I'm quite interested in is, yes, on the one hand, you're seeing that sort of more individualistic in one sense, and certainly the autonomy and the sort of feeling of not just desire for autonomy, but that is what is expected. That's the sort of normal, how you would run your life. But I am seeing at the same time quite a lot of thrust coming from younger people about very big like things like climate change, like broader societal fairness, which are about community. So, you know, I think there's a bit of both. I mean, what you're raising about psychological safety is such an important issue in current times and current challenges. I think an awful lot of the immediate impact of lockdown sat immediately and very heavily on the HR community. And my observation was that of the sort of top things that came up, it wasn't just physical safety and safety in terms of health and public health and, you know, workspace, but it was also psychological safety being a terribly important thing. Are there any sort of really simple practical things that you'd say work or help, perhaps at the management layer, not just the leadership layer? It's a lot of things happened at the management layer in terms of belonging and psychological safety, even in the little things. I suppose it's the things when stuff goes wrong, and the temptation of a manager is to just get incredibly cross and, you know, shut it all down, and then, you know, sort of normal, isn't it, in the hurly-burly, the busyness of business. And what's a way, sort of simple practical things that managers can do to help preserve that psychological safety when things either they've gone wrong or they've suddenly become much more tough?
It sounds like a bit of a cliche, but for me it's about communication and two-way communication. Everybody says this, I guess, but I think you can't really underestimate the importance. I mean, in my experience of talking to employers and people in organisations over the last 4 or 5 months, the organisations that have managed this well are the ones that have really upped their levels of communication. And they've almost held their hands up and said, look, we like to cross all the T's and dot the I's, but at the moment we can't, you know, and we know that you can't either, because we're dealing with this uncertainty and this constantly changing situation.
But, yes, you know, now that's
talk
really
about that and communicate about that and be open about our challenges, and then we can move forward, you know, we can move forward. But we know that things are going to change on an almost daily basis. And I think that openness for me is the way that, you know, you kind of get organized. Then employees feel part of that. And they also feel that not only, you know, that they're allowed to make mistakes, but also that they can kind of accept mistakes perhaps that the management make.
Yeah, so that's two-way as well. So two-way communication, listening and hearing as well as saying, but sharing openness. I guess it's particularly around ethics and safety. This comes up a lot in culture. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's really important is that people say when something's gone wrong. So providing an environment of psychological safety doesn't mean you get away with it. It means it's okay to say something's not okay, because then we can deal with it.
Exactly.
So that psychological contract. But uncertainty is everything. The only certainty at the moment is uncertainty in everything. And we're not brilliantly designed for that. I mean, we're quite good at being designed as human beings for, well, we're a social species. We like exchanging. We're quite good at collaborating. We're quite good at creating and having ideas and innovating. But persistent uncertainty.
Mm.
What's our psychology on that?
Oh, did I say I was a lab psychologist?
You did say that. So let's be fair. Sorry, I've really thrown it. I've just come to me because you mentioned it. We don't like it, do we? I mean, that's the thing.
No, I mean, like, of course we don't like it. I mean, we like to feel secure and safe. And uncertainty doesn't give us those feelings generally, because we like, with the important things in life, we like an element of predictability, actually.
But I like what you've said in a bit of conversation just now, is it's also about the openness of, here's what we know, here's what we don't know. And sometimes just the reassurance of, well, we'll know more by X. So you can kind of have the milestones. It's like providing a stepping stone between things. I think in some ways that part of psychological contract has become really valuable for organizations. There are a few I've seen who have done it very well. I will name ServiceNow, since I've had a really super discussion on some of the work they've done with Pat Waddell. She said it's like chapters. It's like moving through chapters. This is where we're at. This is what we can do. And now there's this bit, and now there's this bit. And it was also framing it like that, I thought, was a very fair way within a psychological contract of making things possible without overload. So I thought that was quite a nice insight. That's a whole other interview. Anything else around our current challenges and what's happening now? What sort of things have you seen in terms of the impact, or any activities or processes that you've seen people instigate, or way that people have dealt with those first couple of chapters and the immediate priorities?
For HR in particular, which is obviously most of the people I talk to in HR are HR directors in organisations. Well, I think it's been a real learning curve, but that's true of most people. I think HR has had to deal with a completely different way of working, not only in terms of the practicalities, but I think HR is very hot on compliance normally, but this is a case where actually we have had to do that page by page, not only chapter by chapter working. You know, it's had to be, right, we're going to do this and work it out as we go along, which is not the way that HR likes to work. We like to plan and, you know, as I said, dot I's and cross T's. So I think we've had to learn to be much more agile and adaptive, which is completely different to how we normally work. In terms of organisations, I think it's been about learning a whole new way of working. I mean, if we're thinking obviously here about people that are perhaps knowledge workers and have been moved at home rather than the frontline workers who are working in the same, you know, in pretty much the same way, albeit under a lot more pressure than they might have been. This en masse home working and the challenges that has brought in terms of communication, collaboration, how you engage people, how you promote belonging when people aren't in the same place. They never see each other unless they turn a computer on and dial in. From the practicalities of learning how to use Zoom, Teams, Google Meetup and 100 other things, it seems like, on an almost daily basis. And also how to use those effectively has been just a massive learning curve. We've seen a transition from the practicalities of how can we carry on getting the job done? You know, so I need to talk to this person about the task, so let's have a Zoom call, to actually, you know, how do I engage with my team? How do I maintain that sense of belonging? So how do I actually try and get some of that more informal communication that actually might build that? You know, I mean, with my team, we've been having twice weekly coffee times because we don't bump into each other in the corridor anymore. So it's, you know, and the rule is we're not talking about work.
That's a nice rule.
We do break that rule every so often, I have to say. But we try not to, you know, and actually that's been quite nice because I've learned a lot more about people in my team. I've met children and dogs and partners that have come into the room and all sorts of things, you know, which has been really nice. But that's
the
way of work.
Yes, sorry.
No,
sorry. The crossover between the personal and corporate has been that, for a lot of people, that is something that they think won't change. But it's been a real mix of those boundaries, perhaps in quite an un-British way, if we talk about British belonging. there are a number of things that I think may be taken into new ways of hybrid working, that mix of remote home working and maybe sometimes going in. But the connectedness, that's the area I'm really concerned about. I think in these first chapters, as you say, the practicality of task-based work or individual work, keep productivity up. People have done amazingly well. We've seen tremendous stuff keeping things ticking along, but it's the interconnections now, the more complex things, people joining new work, people moving along, how do you keep that going? So hybrid working in one sense, but the other area I wanted to make sure we covered in this conversation, so I know one of your particular areas of research in your changing world of work is also the use of tech and AI. And so I'm quite interested in what implications you see for belonging there. I mean, what if some of your colleagues are not only working virtually, but are virtual workers? What happens there?
Well, I'm not sure at this point we know. I mean, what's interesting is that I think up to 2020, certainly, the use of AI was probably dramatically over-exaggerated, and actually organisations weren't really using that much AI in the true sense. I mean, we've seen an increase of using algorithms and such like for, you know, for making decisions and so on, but we haven't really seen AI. And then, of course, what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 months is this is another trend that's accelerated quite dramatically, where we've suddenly seen kind of increased use of robotics for anything from cleaning floors to, if you live where I live, to delivering the shopping, which I still can't get used to, nearly crashing into robots when I walk down the road or everywhere here.
Oh, how exciting.
Their sensors don't stop when you nearly crash into them, as well as they make out, put it that way.
Where are you?
Buckinghamshire.
Wow. So you've got robots delivering.
On the edge of Milton Keynes. So.
Oh, well, you're in modern world there.
Yeah. Yeah, so we have seen those trends accelerate. I think that does have some really interesting implications around belonging, but in lots of different ways, actually. I mean, there's some really interesting questions that I don't think we know the answers to. So, you know, so we talk a lot about inclusion, as we said before. But, you know, when you're working in a team that's not completely human, how does that work, for example? Because we're seeing more and more of that. Or where you've got humans that are augmented by technology. Again, we're seeing more and more of that. And there are some real benefits to that. I spoke to someone just before lockdown that was doing some work around cyborgs and inclusion and diversity with cyborgs in the workplace. And it's like, well, how does that work? So I think some of this technology that we're beginning to see is actually really exciting, and it's a really exciting time to be doing work in this area, but I don't really have the answers.
Well, it's something to keep an eye on.
Come back and ask me in a couple of years when we might have done some more research on that.
One of my sometime colleagues is also going to chat to me on this. He's very interested in sci-fi and how sci-fi relates to reality, how, you know, the art influences life and reality, and Asimov's laws of robotics may well come into play, and there's a sort of code of ethics around how robotics is used. So we'll see where that one goes. I mean, another area I must have a look at is, the other day there was a lot of shouting and mild swearing coming from one of my rooms. This is one of the things that happens in Zoom world with a family of teenagers, is you have to put your note up saying no swearing, mum's doing a podcast. And I said, what are you doing? And my son is sort of leaping around with this thing on his head going, I'm playing with my friends. Like, I should be able to see he's playing with friends. So he's had a lot of social contact through VR, through a VR headset. And I'm looking now to see, I mean, that's an obvious and rather nice thing. Maybe people can sort of have their little characters, their little avatars, and meet up in a VR world, all sit at home with their headsets on. I say it's a nice thing, but also part of me thinks it's a horrendous thing because I'm old, you know, so that doesn't feel like really playing with your friends.
It's interesting because we did have a bit of a push on that quite a few years ago now. I don't know if you remember, we had this thing called Second Life where everyone
had
an avatar in Second Life. Yeah. And I think KPMG, I think it was, started running recruitment events in Second Life rather than in real person. And then it kind of died off, I think, because the technology wasn't that good and it wasn't that realistic. It was like being in a computer game rather than...
Yes, so now we're in an...
It's much better, so...
Yeah, the technology is better, the need is more. Rather sweetly, in American politics, there's a few politicians, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who have these little characters in a game called Animal Crossing, which is, you know, it's a sweet, rather innocent game that's not running around and stabbing people like like some of those video games. These little characters are going around and sort of meeting people on the street and saying hello and, you know, how's the community and let's clean up this park together. So there are ways of using all of that as an extension of real human belonging. We'll keep an eye on it, Emma, yeah, and see.
I think one of the things we are bound to see out of this current situation is that I think one of the things I do think we'll see is people travelling less. For what, you know, so I think we will see people less likely to fly, you know, to another country for one meeting and fly back. And so yes. Then some of these technologies will become more and more important, actually, where you do want to run meetings in a more realistic space and you want people to be able to interact and build relationships within those meetings. I think some of this technology, you know, may come into its own.
Well, thank you for all the insights. You shared quite a lot about the changing world of work and our hybrid world of work, home, local, global, AI, human, and all the interactions in between all of that. It's interesting because you've given us a lot of angles on belonging. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add in there before we do our wrap up.
Not really. I guess the only thing I would say is that I think when we go through a situation that we've just been through, quite often organisations tend to neglect belonging to start with, because I think what we see and what we have seen is that the focus becomes very much on the task, about how can we get the job done, naturally perhaps on organisational survival. And I think what we've seen now is that we're beginning to realise the impact that this is having on employees and on their mental health. With people feeling lonely and isolated. Rates of depression have almost doubled since lockdown. So I think now is the time that actually we do really need to focus much more on belonging as something that can really support well-being and positive mental health in employees. So it would just be, I guess, to urge employers, if anyone listens, to do that at this stage.
That's a lovely note to almost close the conversation on. But the closing note is, I'm asking everybody the same question. What for you is a symbol of belonging, whether that's to Cranfield University or any context, any aspect of a community or a tribe or a group that you belong to? What's for you, Professor Emma Parry, a symbol of belonging that really matters to you?
For me, it's not really a symbol, so I'm going to do the typical academic thing and like not avoid your question, but, you know, kind of disagree with your question, because I'm not really a big one for symbols, to be honest with you, Isabel. But I guess what is important for me in relation to belonging, and I've been at Cranfield for 18 years, and I did my PhD before that at Cranfield, so I think you could probably say that I belong, or I feel that I belong there by now. Really and honestly, it's just about feeling that I understand where Cranfield is going and I'm contributing to that. And
oh, that's lovely. I'll have that.
And that's it.
That's absolutely smashing. Professor Emma Parry, Cranfield University, thank you very much indeed for sharing your perspectives on belonging. Have a great day.
Thank you.